that we need to be aware of heading into retirement, or if you're there in retirement, to not get into trouble. So we're going to do that. Now, after I go through everything, we're going to pause, and then the spotlight turns to you. And as I've gone through, you're like, you know, I'd really like to know more about this. So raise your hand, ask some questions, and we're going to go interactively through the material. Now, if you have lots and lots of questions about estate planning, legal document type of things, if the question is going to be answered in the next session, which I hope you'll all be sticking around for, I'll probably just say, hold on to that. We're going to answer it shortly, okay? But if that's not something we're going to specifically get to, we'll certainly go ahead and discuss that question, answer it to the best of our abilities. All right. You ready to begin? I got a thumbs up. I think we're good to go. Now, when I was younger, just want to give you a little story about me. When I was younger, I was learning how to ride a bike for the first time. You know how you had training wheels? And eventually your dad takes the training wheels off and he tries to teach you how to ride the bike and balance. And we went back. We lived near High Point Camp. I think some of you guys know that. I saw you got a t-shirt on right there, the CIA t-shirt. Yeah, good job. My son was at that camp. Well, we were learning how to ride our bikes there on the big parking lot there at High Point. And my dad took the training wheels off, and he's running behind me, and he's holding on to my bike. And I'm like, don't let go, Dad, don't let go. If you let go, I'm going to fall. Don't you dare let go. And I'm going and pedaling as fast as I can, and I turn around, and wouldn't you know, my dad is way back there. All of a sudden, I realize I'm riding my bike for the first time. And I got really excited that I could do this, and I went around the church. And again, and eventually gets to the point where my dad's saying to me, hey, Tim, we're leaving, we're going to head, you got to come on back. We lived about 5 minutes away from church at this point. Well, as a very diligent and honorable son, I disregarded my dad's instructions and went around again. And just as I came around the turn, wouldn't you know what I saw? My dad pulling away in the minivan down the road. So you know what I did? Oh, stink! So I pedaled harder, and I tried to catch up, and my dad was going, admittedly, slowly. And it wasn't like a city road. It was a backcountry road. And this is the first time, mind you, that I've ridden a bike on a road, that I've ridden a bike down a hill. And yes, my dad was going down. It wasn't a particularly steep hill, but it was a hill nonetheless. And I'm pedaling and going as fast as I can, and I'm leaning forward, and I hit a rock. Boom! Flying right over the handlebars, face first, hands first, knees first. I just ripped everything up. My dad got out of the car, feel like, you know, probably not exactly father of the year material, scoops me up with a shovel, throws me in the car, takes me back where my mom, after reaming my dad out, takes care of my wounds. You know, retirement really shouldn't feel like that. For some of us, entering into retirement is a very scary time. Hey, Dad, don't take your hands off the bike. I don't know that I'm going to be able to do it. Today, what I hope to do is be able to give you some of the guide rails to show you where we are within retirement so that you don't make some of the boo-boos that I've seen retirees make. So with that in mind, we're going to talk about number one, retirement income. Now, retirement income, this section really deals with those who have already or who are approaching retirement. So when you're approaching retirement, you're within, say, 5 years, you really need to start thinking through, can my income keep up with retirement? How much am I going to need to retire? So job number one, work on a budget. How much do you need to operate your household in retirement? Number two is, can I afford to stay retired? Once I do retire, will my income be enough? You know, things get cheaper as you get older, right? No? Really? There's this thing called inflation. That's a real thing. It's causing problems. The cost of living goes up. And don't you know, Social Security, they're so nice. They give you something called cost of living adjustments, right? So they recognize that expenses go up. So they increase your monthly amount. Isn't that nice? But then, of course, they also increase the Medicare premium, which essentially leaves you with maybe a dollar more a month. Aren't they nice? The problem is that most of our income in retirement can't keep pace with it. So we have to plan for inflation when we start thinking about retirement. Not only can I afford to retire today on today's income with today's expenses, but what are the expenses going to be in the future? At this point, it would probably help to talk to someone who can forecast that for us, or at least plan out what that inflation could look like in the future. And also, you want to evaluate your various sources of income. You need to find out what income sources you're going to have, whether it's pension. Obviously, find out your Social Security estimate so that you can make your plans. As I said yesterday, I strongly encourage you, don't retire early if you can. There are a couple exceptions where early retirement might make sense. I was talking with a man just the other week or two, who's a single guy, never married, he's barely making a minimum wage. He's 65 years old, and he's thinking about retirement. I don't think it's a bad idea for him to retire at 65, start collecting Social Security, because we've already put things in place where his income is going to go up substantially being retired, collecting Social Security and some of the other things that we've established for him. That's an exception to the rule. Individuals who are married, when there's an age gap between husband and wife, oftentimes we encourage delay that Social Security until full retirement age so that you can maximize your benefit, not just for your lifetime, but also for the life expectancy of your spouse. Number two is banking. So many people think when they retire, well, they should be invested in something that has absolutely no risk, and they'll look at the bank and they'll use bank CDs. Now, does anyone remember from yesterday, what does CD stand for? Who can tell me? Certificate of deposit. Some people call them certificates of depreciation. We tongue-in-cheek call them that, but yes, they are certificates of deposit. They're FDIC-insured vehicles to keep your money safe. The problem is they're keeping your money safe from one of the dangers, but not all of the dangers that you're going to face in retirement. You're not going to have stock market volatility at a bank CD. The price is going to stay rather safe, rather stable. However, inflation could potentially erode the buying power of your money in CDs. That's why we jokingly call them certificates of depreciation, especially when interest rates were so low for so long. We often find many retirees do far better for themselves using a high-yield savings account, maybe even one through an internet bank, I'll talk about those in a moment, or a money market account at the bank. I was told that WSFS, the bank nearby, they have a 2% money market account. I don't know if they have minimum account sizes, but 2% for a money market is fairly good money. It's better than putting it in a CD and locking your money up for an extended period of time. You can also consider using an internet bank, and there are a couple. Capital One 360 is one, and Ally Bank is another, and there are multiple. You can look at bankrate.com, and you can see all of the different banks that are out there. These are FDIC-insured bank accounts that offer a very high interest rate. They can offer those interest rates often because they don't pay tellers to sit behind a counter in a brick-and-mortar store. So they're able to afford slightly higher rates. So that's something to consider, certainly better than Chase paying. Currently, my Chase savings account's at 0.01%. Thanks, Chase. You guys are great. Okay, so banks. Now let's talk about savings bonds. Does anyone here have savings bonds, U.S. savings bonds? I got one. Anyone else? Two? Three? Got a couple people with savings bonds. The thing about savings bonds is they used to be really great vehicles. They used to be variable interest rate vehicles, so you could get it and the rates would go up and down, but generally speaking would have strong interest rates. A savings bond is when you basically lend money to the government and they promise to pay you back. A double E bond, you buy a $100 bond, but you only pay $50. And over time, it'll grow to $100 or maybe even more. But after 30 years, that goes back to 1989. If you have bonds older than that, 1989, they're not paying any interest at all. They stop paying interest after 30 years. So we recommend going ahead and cashing those out and using those cash funds to fill in other areas within your budget. If you have questions about that, schedule a time to meet with Steve and kind of figure out a strategy. One additional way is if you have grandkids who are going to go to college, it is possible to take those savings bonds and use them to transfer tax-free into a 529, a college savings plan. This would be giving that money away to the kids without realizing any income tax on that. So again, if you have questions about that, you can let us know. Investments. This is always fun. We want to reduce and avoid taxes where possible. So there are a number of things that you want to keep in mind. In retirement, should you be using mutual funds or single stocks? We typically recommend for clients that you don't focus on single stocks, especially in retirement. Many individuals have found a lot of success playing the stock market and buying particular companies. I love Amazon. You've got an Amazon distribution center in your backyard. Maybe you want to buy Amazon stock. And, you know, it's done well over the last 5 years. But, and this is a very big but, it may be a good company today, but is it going to still be good tomorrow? Will there be a new company that disrupts Amazon's business? We often find people may get into a good stock for a while, but they get emotionally attached to it. And then as they age, their ability to process and make wise decisions about when to sell that stock may be diminished. They could even be in the hospital and miss a big problem within the stock and lose a lot of money. So we encourage folks, especially in retirement, don't consolidate your money in single stocks. We do think mutual funds tend to be a less risky way to go because mutual funds allows you to have diversification. Now, diversification does not remove and eliminate all risk. It doesn't. But it does help to eliminate some of the risk that any one company could upset the apple cart within your portfolio. You want to keep risk low. You don't want to put all of your money in high growth, high risk stocks. But at the same time, in retirement, you don't want to give up all growth. Some people say when they get to retirement, they want to have no more exposure to the stock market. But the problem is that with inflation, there's really no other proven way to keep pace with inflation other than being involved prudently in some kind of market-based investment, such as a stock, bond, or mutual fund. Now, that doesn't mean you go whole hog into all stock and high risk, but you can manage your risk, and you should have some exposure to the stock market, even in retirement. It's the best way to keep pace with inflation. All right, what about buying and selling silver and gold coins? Gold coins I find to be a really great hobby. My dad tends to collect coins and fancy currencies. It's a fun hobby. It's not a particularly good investment. It tends to be very difficult to actually sell those things, and the taxes on gains on gold is actually really high. So don't trust in gold. We do encourage, if you have a lot of gold, find ways of selling it as the price. You get a price that you like. IRAs, Roth IRAs. If you're investing, you have IRAs. We talked about this last night. One of the things we do like for folks to consider doing is considering donating your RMD. That's the required minimum distribution. You can donate that directly to your church. That's called a qualified charitable distribution. For those who are 70 and a half and above, the government makes you take money out of your IRA, you can choose, rather than receiving the money in cash and donating the cash after taxes to the church, directly designate the church as the recipient of your RMD. That is a good way of reducing taxes for you and furthering the work of the gospel here at this church. If you have highly appreciated shares of stock, let me give you a concept for a moment. In tax world, there's something called cost basis. Cost basis simply means if you buy a stock for $10 and the stock grows to $50 and you sell it at $50, what do you pay tax on? Do you pay tax on all 50? Do you pay tax on the 10? Or do you pay tax on the 40? The answer is you pay tax on the 40. The 10 was after tax dollars, so it's already been taxed, so they're not going to double tax that $10. But the growth is considered gain, so it's subject to capital gains tax. If you have a highly appreciated stock or a highly appreciated mutual fund, that if you were to sell that stock or that mutual fund, you would receive a large taxable gain, consider not donating cash to your church, but rather donating shares of stock or mutual fund. You can donate that share to the church. You get a current year tax deduction for the donation value of that stock on the date of the donation. And the church can then turn around and sell it. And guess what? The church pays zero tax. So it's a very good way of reducing your tax liability, getting a charitable deduction, assuming you can qualify through Schedule A deductions. We talked about that yesterday. The limit's higher now. And the church is able to use those funds to further the gospel. But that's a neat idea. We also talked about the opportunity for individuals in retirement. And I actually have met with a few of you this week who have a low enough income where they can take some or all of their IRA and convert it into a Roth IRA without paying any or with only paying a small amount of taxes. Now, if you have a very large IRA, you would never want to do it all. You don't want to pay taxes on your IRA conversion, but you can if you're working with a tax preparer, you have someone who can give you some advice and counsel, potentially convert some of your traditional IRA into a Roth IRA without paying any taxes. Again, this is specifically for retirees who are in a low income tax bracket. Maybe their only income source is Social Security and maybe a small pension. If you have any questions about that, see me or Steve, and we can go over that in more detail. All right, annuities. Should you buy an annuity in retirement? Yes or no? Is an annuity a good or a bad thing? Well, the answer is it depends. You see, I said yesterday, I don't believe in the arbitrary good or bad of annuities. They're a tool. So it's like asking this question, is a hammer a good tool or a bad tool? What do you mean? Good tool? It's a tool. It depends on what you're using it for. Are you using it to build a birdhouse? Well, a hammer's a great tool. Are you using it to break up a sidewalk? Of course not. That would be a really lousy tool to use. Conversely, if I asked you, is a sledgehammer a good tool or a bad tool? It depends. A birdhouse, that's a bad tool. A sidewalk, that might be a good tool. So think about what you're going to use the annuity for. In some cases, annuities can make sense, but oftentimes I find that they're oversold. They're sold primarily because that's all the person can sell. And when I said yesterday, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I don't like that. I have seen annuities with 17-year surrenders, a 20% redemption penalty, okay? These things are in existence. The longer I tie your money up, the more I get paid. The higher the redemption penalty, the more I get paid. So if I, You know, so if I go to my day job, so I don't teach seminars, stewardship seminars all the time. My day job, I help clients and I manage money. I typically earn 1 to 1.25% every year. That's the fee I charge to manage money. So think with me. Someone comes in and I can make 15% commission. Or I can sell them something and meet with them every year and serve them ongoing and make 1%. Which one's going to be better for me? 15%, let's face it. I get my money up front. I don't have to see you again. Hey, life is good. I encourage you, avoid investments with very long redemption penalties. Avoid those with high redemption fees. Those are not the only option available to you. And if that's the only option that's offered, find someone else. All right. Indexed annuities. Indexed annuities I find to generally be oversold and their benefits being overhyped. So I would generally shy away from equity indexed annuities. They do have their place and they can have value, but it's not for everyone. What about insurance? Should you have insurance in retirement? So what is the purpose of insurance? I suggest to my clients that the purpose of insurance is really to be able to buy time for you to be able to reduce your debt and grow your savings. Because at some point, I would love for you to not have to need insurance in retirement. I don't believe that you should have insurance from cradle to the grave. So most retirees, if they have life insurance, I often look at it from the perspective, does it make sense? Does the cost annually to pay the premiums make sense for the benefit that you're receiving? I often find for many retirees, it actually doesn't make an awful lot of sense. My goal for those who are entering retirement is to hopefully not need life insurance as you go through. It's really hard for me to make a blanket statement. No retiree should have life insurance. No, that I can't say that. Because in many different circumstances, there could be very good and legitimate reasons for having life insurance. Let me give you an example. You have a pension. You selected a pension option that's based on your own life expectancy. I have clients who've done this. I've got a client whose pension option was much higher if they chose the single life. She was younger than her husband. She had more income, had a bigger pension. Her husband had cancer history, and he's older. It made sense in their situation to take a risk. She would take the single life expectancy annuity payment, and then she went out and bought a 10-year, 20-year term policy to be able to cover just in case she died before her husband within the next 20 years. In that case, life insurance in retirement can make sense. So, again, I'm not trying to cast aspersions on anyone who has life insurance, but generally speaking, it's often not needed. All right, long-term care insurance. We talked about this yesterday. It's never before been as needed and critical in the family's financial plan, but never before has been so far out of the reach of the average American consumer. I do suggest that if you can afford it, you should get long-term care insurance. This is not nursing home insurance. It certainly covers nursing home, but it does so much more. Think about you wanting to stay in your home for as long as possible, but you need someone to come into the home to assist you with activities of daily living, bathing, getting up and down, doing some light housekeeping, dressing yourself. All of these things are important elements that are essential for you to be able to stay in your home. Long-term care insurance can assist with helping to make some of that happen if you need it. There are a couple different kinds. There's the pay-as-you-go model. That's the traditional long-term care insurance. We've seen premiums go up every year for the last probably 10 to 15 years on these policies. It's been rather frustrating to me as an individual who has sold them. It puts my clients in a position where they have to make difficult decisions about the benefits that they're going to have. And yet it's really important to keep. And I tell my clients, if you can afford to keep it, you should keep it. However, there are other policies for those who have larger sums of cash. that you can buy a single premium policy that's going to be able to provide that life insurance and long-term care insurance hybrid model. So if you don't use it, you also don't lose that money. Those options can be beneficial as well. Let's move on to real estate. Who here knows about reverse mortgages? Anyone heard about a reverse mortgage? Reverse mortgages are rather interesting things. Reverse mortgages, there are three kinds. There's the true reverse mortgage. So instead of paying your mortgage statement to the bank every single month, the bank pays you a payment every single month. It's like getting a pension guaranteed now for the rest of your life. They're not going to give you an unlimited sum of money. It's based on the value of your home and how much equity is there. There's going to be an interest rate that they assume. So some of your equity you're giving to the bank in order to get that income. And then when you die, the home is sold and the loan is paid off. So that's the traditional kind of pension idea for the reverse mortgage. Then there's a lump sum reverse mortgage. You have a terminal illness, perhaps. You want to take the family to Hawaii for vacation, one last hurrah, last memories, and you want to tap your equity to do that. I don't recommend it, generally speaking, but that's something people do. It's a rather expensive way to go. The third option is a line of credit. This is someone who is house rich but cash poor. They have enough income to cover some of the basic elements of living in their home, but they really can't handle those extra bills, whether it's a car repair or some other regular expense that comes up that's just a little bit more than they can handle on a monthly basis. The line of credit could be beneficial. Here's the thing. Within the reverse mortgage world, these have been missold. There have been bad actors in the reverse mortgage space who have twisted people's arms or candy-coated bad products to make them look better than they are, have hidden the fees that are built into these products, and eventually take an awful lot of the equity from seniors' homes. From my perspective, reverse mortgages are absolute last resort kind of a thing. I would recommend no one go out and get it just for the fun of having a reverse mortgage. They're expensive, oftentimes they're unnecessary, and it can be avoided by having proper planning. Any questions about reverse mortgages? All right, we're going to keep on moving. Some retirees own real estate, rental properties. I really do encourage those, they think they want that rental income to pay them throughout their retirement time frame. I would only encourage an individual to keep a rental property if they have a management system in place to take care of that property so that they don't have to worry about crawling underneath the house or getting up on the roof or in the attic when they're in their 80s. If you have a child who's able to assist you with some of that care, that would be wonderful and ideal. If you don't, you need to work with a management company, and you need to have ample cash reserves. Owning real estate, especially rental real estate, is an expensive proposition. If you don't have adequate cash reserves, you could find yourself getting into trouble and having to bite off more debt. Timeshares. Don't get them. I don't recommend them. They're very expensive. Oftentimes, the benefit, it really doesn't match up with what they're charging for it. Additionally, they talk about the value of this thing. You spend $20,000 to get into it, and guess what? How much are you going to get out on the back end? Zip. In fact, many people are now paying individuals and companies to take timeshares off of their hand. So here's the thing. You spent $20,000 to get the timeshare. You're paying $600 or more dollars every single year in maintenance costs. And then at the end, you have to pay someone to take it from you. It's not always the best option. Do not have it in your own name. Don't die with a timeshare. If you die with a timeshare, it has to go through probate, and it's going to cost more in legal fees and probate costs to take care of that asset than it's actually worth. And think about this. We're going to talk about this later tonight. If you live in Delaware, but the timeshare is in Virginia or Florida or even, God forbid, California, you have something called ancillary probate, which means not only do you have to probate your estate here in Delaware, you also need to do it wherever that timeshare is listed. So don't die with a timeshare. One way to take care of that is to put your child's name on it. I would never recommend that, generally speaking. I don't want any of you to do that with your primary residence. But with a timeshare, it's not worth anything anyway, and it does help to avoid the probate problems. That's just my opinion. All right, enough with timeshares. Taxes. Oh, taxes are fun. We've already actually covered a number of these things. We talked about itemized deductions. We've talked about RMDs. We've talked about donating highly appreciated shares of stock. And we've talked about Roth conversions. A number of the other things here would relate to how long should you keep your tax return. Does anyone know how long you should keep a tax return?
7 years.
7 years. So who has tax returns going back to the 80s? You can be honest. Raise your hands. Look at that. So you can feel free to get rid of the tax returns you have that are older than 7 years unless, and this is a big unless, you want to keep any tax returns for any years in which major financial transactions took place. For instance, you bought a home or a large piece of equipment if you're in a business. You need to keep some of those things. The IRS can only come in and audit you going back 7 years. However, here's another reason why you might want to keep your tax returns. If you've defrauded the government, there is no statute of limitations. They can come back forever. So as long as you're not defrauding the government, you don't have to worry about it. You can get rid of your tax returns older than 7 years, provided you don't have any major transactions taking place. By the way, what do you do with those tax returns when you're done with them? You throw them in the trash can, right? Throw them in the recycling bin, right? Shred them. You need to keep your information safe. There are people who go through trash cans and recycling bins looking for private personal information, bank accounts, credit card numbers, social security numbers, dates of birth. These information pieces that are not widely publicly known and available, they can take that information, steal your identity, and take money and destroy your good name. So make sure you shred, destroy, or even burn those documents. All right, debt. I strongly advise those who are looking to retire to be debt-free by the time they enter retirement. That should be goal number one. If you are not debt-free, we need to minimize debt as much as possible. That means you should not be buying a car, even in retirement, with debt. Look ahead, foresee a danger, prepare yourself, the Bible teaches us. Have reserves set aside. Start funding a car replacement fund so that you don't need to tap into your retirement accounts to buy that car. Let's actually talk about that for a minute. You want to buy a car in retirement. It's going to cost $25,000. Now, if you don't have $25,000 in cash, where's that money going to come from? There are really only two places. You can take a loan, which I don't recommend, or you have to take a distribution from your retirement accounts. Now think with me for a minute. You're a retired person. Your income is, let's say, $60,000 a year through IRA distribution, Social Security, and some other things. And then you need to take an additional $25,000 out of an IRA. Guess what? That IRA has never been taxed. That means the entire amount of that distribution is reportable to the government as tax, as taxable income. So you spend $25,000 for a vehicle, but you'll need to withhold another 15 to 20% just to cover federal income tax. That $25,000 vehicle just cost you almost $30,000. Not particularly a good deal. This is where having Roth IRAs can be a good way to prepare for future car purchases, because distributions from a Roth IRA are not subject to federal income tax. Or you can have the money set aside through setting money into a savings account for a car replacement. Think ahead, prepare yourself. And avoid credit cards in retirement. Make sure you pay your credit cards off every single month. It's not rocket science, but I'm amazed how many times I actually need to say that. Please pay off your credit cards. All right, estate planning. We need to have a Christian's will. What's a Christian's will? Stay tuned. We're going to tell you in a minute. Have a Christian's will. You need to have medical and financial powers of attorney. Power of attorney documents are for when you are living. They say who's allowed to make decisions for you on your behalf. And on the medical side, they may even indicate what some of those life and death decisions you would prefer. It's important that you have a power of attorney document. All of us need one. We also need to make sure that we think about probate. Who here has heard of probate? Who here has heard of the awful evil of probate? How the boogeyman probate is going to come and steal all of your money. Oh my word, probate is so bad. Let me tell you about the thousands and thousands of dollars and the weeks and months and years you're going to be stuck in probate while you try to sell your assets and all the money that goes to those big fat cat attorneys that just get fat on all those probate fees. Oh, you can avoid it by just buying this fancy trust. If you put all of your money into this living trust, it only costs $3,500, but it's going to save you so much more. Doesn't that sound good? Who wouldn't want to save tens of thousands of dollars and all the time and frustration of probate by just investing $3,500 into this really simple living trust that's about this thick, written in Latin and Greek? We're going to explain what a living trust is in the next session, but oftentimes living trusts are unnecessary. And we'll explain times when it might make sense to use a living trust and often when it doesn't make sense. And we will also talk about probate. It is a real thing. It is an issue that you need to acknowledge and potentially avoid, but it's not the boogeyman. And then I love this one. Keep your family informed of your estate plans. If you make decisions to do something funny with your estate, you're not going to divide it evenly. You're going to do something here and something over there. The absolute worst time for your family to find out about your very unique plan is at the attorney's office after you're dead and can't explain what you were thinking. Please love your children, love your heirs enough to sit them down and have a conversation. We encourage families to have an annual family meeting, one that talks not just about what your will states, and that's important. You need to talk about what to expect, but also to talk about what's important to you. Are you passing on only your valuables to your family? Or are you also sharing with them your values? Do they know how to handle and manage money? Do they understand the significant moments in your life that formed your view and understanding of money? Do they know what your first memory is of money? Some of these questions are so profound that even for you and for your spouse, it can help build a level of understanding and trust. But imagine what this can do with your children as they begin to gain a new appreciation for all that God has done in their parents' lives, so that you can not just pass the valuables that God leaves you, but also pass on your values. So keep your family informed. Husbands, share with your wives. One gentleman came up to me yesterday and said, hey, you know what? You said share with your wives tonight, but I think you need to go one step further. You need to sit down with your wives, this gentleman was saying, and you need to tell them where to go to pay the bills, who does what, how does this happen. And he actually pulled out this whole 6-page sheet, which goes through everything they own, all of the way he handles their finances and investments, with detailed paragraph explanations of everything involved. That is focus, that is attention, and I think that is a wonderful way to love your spouse. Keep your spouse informed. Share with them what you're doing. Make sure that they know what's going on. My wife, every year, I do almost the exact same thing. I have a 6 to 7 page document that I print out that goes through where our family is right now, what our goals are for 10 years, where we are with our assets, where our money is at, who handles our taxes, who's our attorney, who handles the insurance, how much life insurance do I have, how much disability insurance do I have, what are the companies, where are they at? All of this information I lay out for my wife because if I get hit by a bus, she needs to know what to do. Final expenses, prepaying versus pre-planning. When you go to the nursing home or to the funeral home, they're going to talk to you about how you can prepay for your final expenses. We, and frankly, Consumer Reports has found that it's often better to pre-plan rather than to prepay your final expenses. Things often change. They find that what they thought was full and complete payment actually didn't cover everything, like opening the grave or the headstone or the foundation where the headstone is resting. There are a lot of things that can be missed. So pre-plan, pre-fund. You can set money into something called an irrevocable burial reserve account. That account allows the funds to be outside of your estate and allows it to be available after your death to cover those final expenses. It also is not subject to Medicaid for those who may be concerned about that. The average cost, it says here $7,500. Actually, I think the average cost is now closer to $10,000 to $12,000 for the average funeral without getting all the bells and whistles on your casket. There are guaranteed and non-guaranteed funerals, so pay attention to that. The Federal Trade Commission says that prepaying is not a good idea. Insurance policies sold by the insurance homes are usually not a particularly great option. And Medicaid planning using an irrevocable burial reserve account can be very beneficial. And the final thing, perhaps, that I want you to focus on is the biggest danger to your retirement is actually one word. It's called procrastination. You've probably sat here and listened to any number of things that I said today, and you thought to yourself, oh, that's a good idea. I should do that. You know what? I need to get my legal house in order. You know, I need to have this conversation with my kids. And you have all these wonderful ideas, these great hopes and aspirations, but let's face it. You've been around for a while. You know how this goes. You have really good intentions. And then life gets busy. You leave here and life carries you down the road. Do not procrastinate. My challenge to you tonight is write down two things. What are the top two things that you want to do and implement in your family this week? If you're married, I want you to commit to each other as husband and wife what those two things are. And the time frame in which I want you to accomplish those two things. What are the two most important, high value, high impact things you can implement in your family tonight? If I stand up here and I just spent an hour telling you what to do, teaching you about these things, and you don't implement them, I'm wasting my time. Please implement, don't procrastinate. I've spent a lot of time. I've talked longer than I wanted to. What are some of the questions that you have that we might be able to address? Sir. Okay. So is that just a comment or was there a question there? I'm not sure. Yeah, yeah. So the comment was, I don't know if everyone can hear that, someone borrowed money on their first mortgage and the interest got really out of control, went really high, and started costing them an awful lot of money, more than was expected. Yeah. Any other questions? Thank you. Yes, ma'am. There are many ways to minimize and avoid probate. Again, probate's not necessarily a bad thing. There can be ways in which probate's actually beneficial. But right now, we're going to cover this in a little bit, but there are non-probate transfers. So if you have an IRA, that's automatically going to transfer by contract to the individuals who are named beneficiaries. You can do that with bank accounts, and you can do that with investment accounts which are not IRAs. At the bank, it's called in trust for, or some states call it POD, payable on death. In the investment world, it's called TOD, transfer on death. This is simply a way of adding a beneficiary to an account so that it goes directly to the children. One danger here: estate liquidity is a real important need. When you die, your estate is going to need money to operate. There will be bills that will need to be paid. There may need to hire someone to fix up your house or to even sell your house, to paint it, to do whatever. There may be expenses that you'll incur that your estate will need to cover. If you take all of your bank accounts and put a beneficiary on it, there won't be any cash with which the estate can operate. So make sure you consider estate liquidity. Make sure not everything goes around probate. You do need to have some assets there. Life insurance is another example of a non-probate transfer.
But you couldn't do real estate that way, right?
Some states will allow you to. I don't think the state of Delaware allows you to do a deeded transfer to a beneficiary. I know they allow you to do that in Florida, for example. Yes, sir.
Relative, and with a certain title that allows it to transfer.
Really?
It's a bad idea.
Okay, it's a bad idea. Don't do it.
Because the beneficiary doesn't get the stepped-up basis.
Okay. Brilliant, right? So here's what he's saying. With you can do it.
Brilliant. I did. That's what I was laughing.
I'm saying he's brilliant. He's a smart guy. Okay. No. What I'm saying is that when you leave an asset to an heir, in the stock and bond world, mutual funds, if you leave your home to your kids, if you paid $100,000 for it, it's worth $300,000 today. They get it with a stepped up basis. The basis, $100,000, jumps to the value of the asset as of the date of your death. That's amazing. They will pay zero tax on the sale of that in that product, that home. But if you do this, if you add that title so that the child takes over the property, they actually don't receive the step-up basis. They receive the basis that you had, that $100,000, potentially causing tax problems. Make sense? If you have your home and it's just in your name alone, your basis, what you paid for the home, is $100,000. Its value is now $300,000. You pass away. Your children inherit your house, but instead of inheriting your $100,000 basis, the basis, the law says, jumps to the value of the home as of the date of your death. That is a wonderful feature that the government allows. It saves your children from having to pay federal income tax on the sale of your home. Now, if we go over here, same situation, $100,000 basis, $300,000 home. But instead of leaving it to your kids in your will, you go to the courthouse and you say, add this special title so that my relative can inherit this home. You have now bypassed the process by which the stepped-up cost basis happens. You pass away. It doesn't go through probate. Your heirs inherit that house with your $100,000 basis, causing them to, when they sell it, have a rather large taxable gain. Yes, please, be a nuisance. Go ahead. That's just common for what everyone says about you anyway. No, just kidding.
Somebody that is related to me plans on putting her house into a her children's estate. Mm-hmm. And she has a property
Yep.
Is that okay?
It's a bad idea. Don't do it. Why? So many reasons. But number one, cost basis. You're bypassing the entire stepped up cost basis benefit. So you don't get that.
Right.
Number two, it's considered a gift. So if for whatever reason, within 5 years of that gift, they need to go and qualify for Medicaid, that's welfare insurance, they would be disqualified from benefits until a certain period of time has elapsed based on the value of that gift. So that's a problem. But number two, is she still living in that property but now has the child as the owner? The problem is if that child is in a car accident, goes into a divorce, is sued for any reason, her home could be party to that lawsuit. Another thing we've actually seen, I was talking to someone about that today, an individual did this. They put their home in the name of their child. Their child went into the hospital, died, was on Medicaid for a period of time, and the government put a Medicaid lien on the home of the parent who had given that home to their child because that was an asset of the child, not the parent. So there are all kinds of ways in which that could be a really bad idea.
And it's also an asset in bankruptcy. So if your child were to file bankruptcy,
absolutely,
the bankruptcy trustee could see part of the house, just like the hospital did.
Thank you, Lacey. That is absolutely correct.
Thank you, guys.
Good job. Go ahead.
My partner, Gene, is an expert at this stuff. And if you have these kind of questions, we'll tend to your answers, usually free of charge. People do treat the probate process as if it is a boogeyman to be avoided at all costs.
Yeah.
And there's some reasons to treat or limit what's in probate.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Buying those expensive trusts as opposed to just going through the probate processes is over in about 9 months, and you only have about 3 months interactions with the state. It's just most people do it on their own.
So, another thing you need to be aware, buyer beware. There are folks out there who are pushing trust seminars. And they'll have you come to a restaurant, they'll pay for this nice meal, and they will tell you about the horrors of probate in California and how it's expensive and crazy and really bad. But the reality is, that's California. That's not Delaware. So they're telling you about real problems for not you. So know about this. It could be a really slick presentation that is slick sales, but not really substance. Hey, we've reached the end of the time that we have allotted. You have been amazing. Go ahead, stand up, take a break, use the bathroom, grab a little bit more food, but then come back. We're going to have more fun, and we're going to dive deeper into estate planning.